You're listening to sermon audio from Christchurch Hawthorne in Melbourne. We hope and pray this helps you grow in your knowledge and love of God and enables you to see how great God is.
Time for our first Bible reading this morning. And it comes from the Gospel of Mark. Gospel of Mark, chapter 15, verses 1 to 40. And as soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." And the chief priests accused him of many things. And Pilate again asked him, "Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Now at the feast, he used to release for them one prisoner for whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison, who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. And he answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with the man you call the king of the Jews?" And they cried out again, "Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him!" So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he's calling Elijah." And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." There were also women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, the younger, and of Joseph and Salome.
We're reading from Romans chapter 1, verse 16 to 23, followed by chapter 3, verse 19 to 26. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, "The righteous shall live by faith." For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. Chapter 3:19 to 26. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus.
Thanks very much, Andy and Emmeline, for those readings. Perhaps I might just say a short prayer. Let's bow. Father, may your word dwell in our hearts and bear much fruit to your glory, for Christ's sake. Amen. What's the biggest thing in the universe? As someone who's studied some science, I've been fascinated by a series of images that I've seen recently, which show in a great long sequence of images from the beginning, one image that attempts to show the whole universe as we know it. Well, it's an imaginary image. No one could take a photo of it. But it shows many, many galaxies in the vast expanses of space, space that's so big that light takes millions of years to travel across the breadth of the universe. And then in the series of images, it narrows down, a photo just of, an image just of one galaxy, and an image just of a section of a galaxy, an image just of a few stars, an image of the solar system with our one star, the sun, narrowing down, an image of the Earth, which is just a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the whole universe. And then narrowing down from the whole expanse of the Earth to just an aerial image of one country and one city and one street, and coming into the dimensions that we're used to as human beings, the sort of distances that we experience in our daily lives, meters or perhaps hundreds of metres or perhaps a few kilometres. Narrowing down from a human to something small, an everyday object, narrowing down smaller than that, starting to look at microscopic images, the fine detail of things that we take for granted each day, going down smaller than that to things that we can't see with the naked eye at all, but which microscopes have revealed to us. And then tiny little organisms, much too small to see, but yet living things. Smaller than that, to the molecular structure of the compounds that we have in everyday life. Smaller than that, to atoms and subatomic particles, and even neutrinos that I mentioned last week. There are many, many orders of magnitude going from one to the other. The scale of things that exist in the universe. But what's the biggest thing in the universe? Well, perhaps different people might have different answers for that. But it's worth pausing for a moment to consider how we see ourselves in all of that. Do you tend to see yourself as bigger than many things in the universe, or do you tend to see yourself as smaller than many things in the universe? A number of people have commented on the way in which we as human beings see ourselves in the environment in which we find ourselves. In today's Age website, I haven't bought the physical paper, but there's an article by Brian Rosner, who will be appointed the principal of Ridley College here in Melbourne, in which he reflects upon the inclinations of people to live, to be true to ourselves. You know, that sort of saying that people say, sort of advice on how to live your life, be true to yourself. And Rosner suggests that that can become a justification for doing whatever you want. If you treat other people badly, I'm being true to myself by doing this. I can't help the consequences that it has on other people. When we think like that, we're perhaps making ourselves to be the biggest thing in the universe. We're saying that I, myself, in my own identity, in my own existence, I'm the thing that matters most. It's putting self right there in the centre. C.S. Lewis, who's, as well as having written on a number of Christian subjects, is also an historian and a literary commentator, has tracked the way in which humans generally have tended to see themselves in the universe over time, and said that the ancients generally, going back 1,000 years or two or three, tended to see themselves as small in the universe. And they tended to see that they had to come to terms with a universe that wasn't always friendly. And they tended to see that as humans, we had to fit in with the universe. But in contrast, C.S. Lewis suggests that many moderns, or postmoderns like us, tend to think that we will make the universe fit in with us. We will make our surroundings behave in a way that we want them to, so that we can achieve what we want. We've got used to thinking that humans are relatively big and that the rest of reality around us is not so big, not so important. Indeed, I've reflected upon this because in a slightly different way, because for some years I lived in rural areas in the outback of New South Wales, where most of the time, much of what I was looking at with my eyes, much of what I saw, was not man-made. And so the impact of human beings was less obvious. Living in an urban environment like most of us do here in Melbourne, much of what we see with our eyes day to day is man-made. And we therefore tend to think of humans and of what humans have done as being more important. We tend to think of ourselves as bigger, if I can put it that way. And the rest of the unit, the rest of reality is smaller. And this may affect our thinking. Of course, whether we are the centre of the universe or whether other things are bigger than us is not only determined by our perceptions of that. We may be filled with our own importance, but then something might happen to us that reminds us that, in fact, we don't control everything. J.R.R. Tolkien's book, The Lord of the Rings, is a story about the negative consequences of when people, well, the characters in his story, I'm not quite sure if they're people, but desire power and control above other things that matter more. So we can perceive a tendency anyway amongst humans to want to make ourselves the centre of the universe, to want to make ourselves the biggest thing that there is. But I want to make a couple of conclusions from that observation, that we tend to want to put ourselves at the centre. Two conclusions from that. Just because we might want to put ourselves at the centre doesn't mean that that is how it actually is. The second conclusion is that, in fact, to try to put ourselves at the centre of the universe is, in fact, the nature of what the Bible calls sin. From the Bible's perspective, sin ultimately is not simply doing some particular bad things, but it's wanting to define the way we conduct ourselves by whatever we want ourselves, rather than wanting to define how we live by what God says to us, by the bigger reality, as we believe as Christians, the bigger reality of God. Sin is saying, I want to define my universe my way and act accordingly and leave God out of the picture. I want to explore today the objection that some people have for Christianity, that is, that God sends people to hell. How can a good God send people to hell? People ask that. They say, God is supposed to be a God of love. How can God be a God of judgment who would send people to hell? Why can't God just forgive? Can God be a God both of judgment and love? Well, from the introduction of thinking about putting ourselves at the centre of the universe, I want us to pause for a moment and reflect. Just because we might want things to be a certain way doesn't mean that that's how they are necessarily. We might want in our minds to have an image of a God who is always loving and never acts in judgment, but that doesn't mean that that's how God is. In fact, to think that God is just a God of love only and not a God of goodness or righteousness or judgment is to invent God according to our own image. Indeed, to believe in a God like that would be purely an act of faith with no basis in anything. There's no revelation of God from God that shows us that's just a God of love and no judgment, no justice. At least when we turn to the Bible, we have evidence of God in various ways, not least in the person of Jesus. But the evidence that we have of God in the Bible speaks to us of a God who is both love and justice. A God who actually cares about what we do. A God who has standards. Certainly a God who acts in love, but we need to understand the love of God over against God's justice. We shouldn't just make ourselves the centre of the universe and then invent the God that we would like to have. If God is God, if he's bigger than us, if he has any sense of goodness, then it's reasonable to understand that God is also a God of judgment. How can we have good if there isn't an opposite of good? What does it mean, in fact, to have good without the contrast of evil or bad? Perhaps you've heard some of the good news, bad news jokes. You know, the doctor says to the patient, well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that they've named a disease after you. Do I need to tell you the bad news? But can you think of good news that doesn't have a shadow of bad news? I can't think of anything. Whatever good news there is, then the opposite thing happening would be the bad news. Whatever concept we have of good, then there is inevitably a shadow of bad. And if God promotes light, then God is unhappy with darkness. If God promotes love, then God is unhappy with rejection, with alienation, with hate. If God promotes truth, then God is against liars. Whatever good you want to hold up, then that immediately brings into reality, into the possibility of the opposite existing also. And so if we think of God as in some way good, then we have to see that God is against bad. You can't have a God who is just pro-good. It doesn't make sense. And the Bible doesn't reveal that sort of God to us either. The God that we have in the Bible who's bigger than us, who exists independently of us, is a God who is positively interested in good, but who is against bad. A God who is interested in truth, but who is against lies. A God who wants us to know him as the one true God, and therefore is against us thinking that God is irrelevant, or that God is not true, or that we are the centre of the universe ourselves. It has to be like that. And so we can't, it's foolishness to think that we can have some sort of loving God who only ever affirms positively and doesn't ever reject anything. Indeed, the Bible reveals to us a God who does reject darkness, who rejects sin, that is, us rebelling against God. Furthermore, the Bible presents this God as being the biggest thing in the universe. In fact, the one bigger than the whole universe, who caused the whole universe to come into being. And so if we set ourselves against God, then we find that he is over against us. We find God's judgment against all who suppress the truth, who rebel against the truth of the universe, that is, that God is God. So we have consistently in Scripture this picture of God's goodness, but that means also God's judgment. Well, what is hell? Can a good God consign people to hell? Hell is, in fact, it's not just one concept, it's not just one word, but in the Bible we find a number of different words that are sometimes used to present various images of hell, of God's judgment. One of the images that's used is the name of the garbage tip outside Jerusalem. That was one of the words used for hell, for what God rejects, which is one way of thinking about it. And I guess over the years we have various caricatures and cartoons of what hell would be like. And I guess people in their imaginations have created all sorts of ideas of what hell would be. But consistently the Bible presents hell as being the absence of God, being excluded from the presence of God. And C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce, which I certainly encourage you to have a look at, it's not actually about marriage and divorce. It's about the separation that takes place between God and people who want to go away from God. C.S. Lewis says that ultimately the separation is between those people who would say to God, God, your will be done. In other words, go God's way. And those people to whom God says, okay, your will be done. Have it your way. You want to exclude me, God, out of the picture, then go your way. Which actually means going away from God and experiencing the absence of God, which the Bible calls hell. Now, none of us have been to hell, so we don't know what it's like. And sometimes people get themselves caught up in arguments about exactly what the nature of hell will be and what the nature exactly of the punishment would be and exactly what it would mean to be cast out of God's presence. But for me, it's enough to think that to be completely removed from all the goodness of God would be horrific, would be terrible. I don't think most people in the Western world realize the extent to which many benefits of our society actually come from the influences of Christian faith over the last couple of thousand years. I've mentioned this over the last couple of weeks in other sermons, but a number of people have borne testimony to the influence of Christian faith and the Bible in movements and changes and reformations that have taken place in society, including, for example, the abolition of slavery. But many of the things that we take for granted as being good and worthy values of life in our society are in fact Christian values that teach us to behave in a way that's not how we would naturally behave. When the Bible teaches us that truth is actually worth living by rather than lies, that's contrary to our nature, but it's something that we've come to learn and perhaps take for granted. But hell then, as pictured by the Bible, is to be separated forever from God and from all the good things that come from God. We need to understand that is, it's not that God lacks love, but that's inevitably how it will be if God is the God of truth. And if God is pro-good, then he's anti-bad. But what about the love of God then? The love of God actually steps into that scenario. You've got a scenario of God being pro-good and anti-bad, and you've got people who are inclined to go bad, who are inclined to reject God and want to establish the universe around ourselves. But God steps into that with his love. And that's really what we're on about here today on Good Friday. What we're celebrating and remembering is God stepping into that universe, saying, although people have rejected God and deserve to be excluded from God, God wants to do something about that. God sent Jesus in order to make it possible, in order to open the door, to open a wide gate for us to be reconciled back to the perfectly good God. God knows that there have to be consequences for bad, for rejection of God, for going our own way. But God sent Jesus in the world so that Jesus could take upon himself those bad consequences. Some people say, oh, why can't God just forgive? Why does God have to put all the punishment on somebody else, that is on Jesus? Why can't God just forgive? That misunderstands the nature of the contrast, of the divorce between good and bad. Bad must be rejected. When Jesus came into the world, when Jesus got up on the cross, there's a picture of it there, picture of Jesus up on the cross. What were some of the words that he cried out? My God, why have you forsaken me? Said Jesus. He was actually quoting from Psalm 22. Or I think to put it another way around, God had scripted already in Psalm 22 what Jesus was going to say on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus was telling us what was going on at that moment. Jesus was being forsaken. Jesus was being cast out by God the Father because Jesus was taking upon himself the rebellion, the sin, the blackness, the dirtiness of our human lives, taking it on himself and being rejected by God. Theologians argue about whether Jesus went to hell at that moment when he died. I'm not going to solve the theologian's argument, but it's clear that Jesus accepted on himself God's punishment, God's rejection. But that was in fact God's love to us. The reason God did that, the reason Jesus accepted that, was so we can be forgiven, we can be liberated. That burden is taken from us. We ourselves don't have to go to hell. If anyone says to me, why does a good God consign people to hell? I'll say, God's opened the way for us to avoid that hell. Some years ago, when I was on a beach mission, an evangelistic outreach, I had spent some time, maybe over 15 or 20 minutes, explaining the basic idea of Christian faith to some people about how God had revealed himself to us in Jesus and God had opened the way for us in Jesus to be reconciled back to God himself. And these couple of people thought for a moment and then said, maybe we're worse off now because now we know. See, before that, they didn't understand anything about where they stood before God. And they thought that they weren't particularly rejecting God. But once they had understood what I'd explained to them, they could see that if they continued to reject God, they were indeed a lot worse off. But at the same time, if they responded to what God had provided for them, then of course they're much better off. And that's really the point. We shouldn't just sit deliberating, why does God send people to hell? We should say, let's accept the free gift that God has given us in Jesus and get on the right side. Let's accept the love of God, which God extends. God extends the invitation to everyone. God so loved the world that he gave his only son so that whoever believes will not perish but have eternal life. The invitation is there. Don't sit by idly philosophically contemplating people being excluded from God. Rather, make sure that you're one of those people who is reconciled to God and call on everyone else, as many as possible, to be reconciled to God as well. That's what Good Friday is about. When Nat and I were planning this preaching series and thought we'd deal with some of these objections to Christian faith, it seemed to me that the concern about God sending people to hell fitted in exactly with the message of Good Friday. Because Good Friday is doing something about hell. It's doing something about the rejection from God and calling people to be reconciled to God instead. So I want to conclude by saying that God has acted in love to save us from hell. God is indeed a God of love. And that love is acting to save us from hell. In a few moments, we'll share together in communion. In practical terms, can I just say that we've got a common silver cup with wine that you can have a sip from, but if you'd prefer to take a small individual cup on your way forward, then we'll give you some grape juice individually instead. That's okay. We've got bread, but if you need gluten-free, just indicate that. We've got some gluten-free wafers there. I suggest you come up on the right-hand side this way. If you've got a dirty cloth, get rid of it in that basket. Take an individual cup if you like. Then we share together in bread and wine up the top. Coming back on the other side, you can put your little individual cups in the basket at the bottom if you wish, but then please take a clean white cloth, an expression of God's forgiveness through us in Jesus on the way back. Let me conclude by reading a poem from George Herbert, written about 400 years ago. Quite amazing, really, the depth and power in these poems from Herbert, I think. The poem's called The Agony. Philosophers have measured mountains, fathomed the depths of seas, of states, of kings, walked with a staff to heaven and traced fountains. But there are two vast, spacious things, the which to measure it doth more behove. Yet few there are that sound them, sin and love. Who would know sin? Let him repair unto Mount Olivet, and there shall he see a man so wrung with pains that all his hair, his skin, his garments bloody be. Sin is that press and vice which forceth pain to hunt his cruel food through every vein. Who knows not love, let him assay and taste that juice which on the cross a pike did set again a broach. Then let him say, if ever he did taste the like, love is that liquor sweet and most divine, which my God feels as blood, but I as wine. Let's rejoice in the love of God that saves us from being excluded from God.